The problem was that when you're like working in a company and all of a sudden like it gets bought and like it's starting to do criminal things, it's like you can't go to like HR and be like, can I like file like a complaint against the entire company for being criminal?
Who or what shapes our worldview? Obviously, we can't blame everything on algorithms for creating filter bubbles, since there's also our mental algorithm filtering out things we don't like or don't want to hear. We're all trapped in bubbles of false objectivity, in which we believe we know what's going on in the world and how to interpret it, where it's only a reflection of our beliefs influenced by our experiences. I'm a journalist and author based in Sweden, where I cover politics and technology. I run a podcast called Perspective, or Perspectives in English, where I meet people that can provide in-depth perspectives on current affairs, technology, sustainability, and design. It's in Swedish, but every now and then I have an English-speaking guest, and I then try to do all English episodes as well. So, if you like what you hear, please subscribe and tell a friend. Anyway, as a journalist, I'm supposed to be objective. But since no one really can be objective, I felt I needed to be aware of my own biases and misconception, as well as sharing with the audience what the perspectives I have, in order to gain their trust and try to get as close to the truth as possible in my own reporting. So I have to explain where I'm coming from, if I can, if that will help the audience understand where I'm coming from. To become more aware of how we get caught up in these kind of bubbles, I wrote a book called The Big Bubble, in which I try to explain how algorithms, the changing media landscape, and new means of communication influence our perception of reality. Still, it's not a book about technology, but rather a reminder that bubbles have always existed, online and offline. And then help you change your bubbles, understand how you can change your bubble, at least from within. And that book, The Big Bubble, is available in digital and printed editions, and you can find it wherever you find English books in your part of the world. And at the end of the show, you can hear me read an excerpt from the book. Anyway, I'm telling you all this because one of the things I discovered when writing The Big Bubble was the fact that you can enter someone else's bubble and changing it by mapping that person's beliefs and political views in what is called psychometrical analysis. So, should I ask you to complete a simple Facebook quiz or of a familiar type, say, which character in Game of Thrones do you look like the most? And then maybe add a few simple questions about your personality, and then at the end ask for your permissions to do an analysis of your profile picture. I'd then be able to scrape all kinds of data from your profile page, and then secretly use that data to understand who you are by comparing that data to thousands and even millions of other users' data. So, this isn't science fiction, but a method that works today and has been working for a few years now. This newfound insight on how much someone else can find out about us and then make predictions, and the amount of personal information we actually give away, that dominated the discussion around online privacy and social media in 2018, especially with folks on Facebook. And the reason for this was a scoop done by The Guardian, The New York Times and Channel 4 in the UK, in early spring of 2018. What became known as the Cambridge Analytica scandal revealed just how much this British data mining company got hold of and then used that data about millions of people in order to influence them in the Brexit referendum and also in the 2016 presidential election in the US. That scoop originated from a whistleblower named Christopher Wiley, a programmer who was the man behind the algorithms that was enabling mass customization of messages. Later, he left the company and eventually started to share his perspective with a journalist. You'll hear more about that later in the show. So, I can't think of anyone better suited to talk about big bubbles of our time than him. And that's why I invited him to chat with me during the release of my book in January 2019 in front of a live audience. Mr. Wiley knows more than most people of how this stuff works, but after the revelation about Cambridge Analytica, he's also become a vocal critic of social networks and their inability to take responsibility of our own personal data. And that's why he's been invited to do hearings in the US Congress, in the European Parliament, as well as in the UK Parliament. So, before we begin, I should say that Christopher Wiley is at the same time very easy and very difficult to interview. Many times I found myself wanting to interrupt him, But since what he has to tell is so fascinating, and he's a good storyteller too, I often let him continue. Especially at the beginning of this conversation, where he maps the entire history of how we got into this mess. He's also sharing some of the details that, to my knowledge, hasn't been published before, and talked about how he ended up working as a head of research for one of the world's biggest fashion company, which is his new job, and you'll hear about that at the end. And, as I said, if you're interested in understanding more about technology and our mental filters and how they are making it harder to understand the world, I added the introduction of my book as a bonus at the end of this episode. Hey.
Hey.
Which is
my one Swedish word.
Yes. So.
Oh, no, I can say two. Hey, hey.
Hey, hey. Yes, yeah. That's true.
Extra Swedish.
So you have sandwich, we have snacks, we have champagne. This is supposed to be the British Queen, her favorite.
It is what the Queen drinks. And that's not just me.
Are you on like some kind of Queen diet here? No?
If this is a Queen diet, then great.
How has this last year been for you?
It has been bizarre. I think is the bizarre and amazing and scary and lots of adjectives that I could probably continue to add on to that. Going from trying to keep everything quiet and constantly focusing on keeping things quiet until an investigation, you know, is at a point where the authorities have enough information or journalists have enough information, and constantly being vigilant about, you know, who knows what and all that, to boom, you're on the front cover of, you know, two of the largest newspapers in the world, and the media descends on you, and then the drastic difference from total quiet to being out there, it's quite a thing. It's hard to describe.
So you sort of came out in March last year.
So to speak.
When did you...
Used to it.
When did you actually blow the whistle? How long was that sort of period?
I kind of hate the expression blowing the whistle, because like it's not, you know, it's very rare that there's just like a moment that you've gone, you know, I can't actually whistle, so pretend I just whistled, you know, where you actually quote blow a whistle or you say, you know, look at this, because, you know, in my case, and I know with several other quote-unquote whistleblowers, this has also been the case, where it's sort of a process. You start to talk, you start to share information, you then, you know, possibly either work with journalists or work with, you know, police investigators. In my case, it was both. Over the process of, you know, in my case, a year, and even before that, trying to get people to pay attention to something that they weren't really paying attention to until, you know, Trump got elected. So for me, it was a quite a long process. So I guess it was a slow, I don't know, massaging of a whistle, or like a gentle breeze through that whistle until it got louder and louder and louder.
So there wasn't a specific tipping point or anything where you said that, okay, now,
I mean,
damn it.
You know, I think one of the things that I tried to explain to people is, like, you know, when I first started, you know, I'd prior to Cambridge Analytica, I'd worked in progressive politics throughout my entire life. I'm a very progressive-minded person. And, you know, when I first started, it was a company called SCL Group, which was a British military contractor. And essentially, after working for years in Canadian politics and governments and the British government, you know, I got offered a position to work in a national security context, which I thought was really interesting, because at the time, DARPA, which is the U.S. military's research agency, and DISTL, which is the British version.
DARPA, who invented the internet, you could say.
Yeah, lots of people apparently invented the internet. But yeah, one of the contributors to the internet. But when the Western militaries started realizing that, you know, constantly spending money on, you know, missiles and tanks and all that actually isn't necessarily keeping people safe, because when you look at modern security threats like ISIS, you know, these are people that wage a lot of their wars through cultural narratives, and, you know, that happens online. And the military is not good at understanding technology, frankly, because, you know, I can't actually work in the army, right? So, you know, and if you're a really talented, you know, engineer or data scientist, you go and work at Google because you can have, you know, neon hair and nose rings and whatever. You don't work in the army, even though that's the kind of talent the military needs for national security. So instead, they spend lots of money doing R&D projects with companies like the one that I worked at, trying to understand how we can use data, you know, through social media and the internet to identify potential security risks, you know, whether it's a recruiter, somebody who's potentially prone to, you know, join some kind of extremist group, and then stage interventions with that knowledge, whether that's a physical intervention or whether that's an informational intervention.
Essentially, would that still be considered as a defense, or would that be a...
You know, when we, depending on the project, the company worked on both defensive and offensive operations. Yep. Like, I, you know, don't hide the fact I did weapons research. That's what I did. You know, in military doctrine, you have sort of a distinction between what you call kinetic weaponry. So that's like ballistics and explosives, where you deny, you know, your opponent through physical or kinetic force. And then you have something called non-kinetic weaponry, where you deny the objective of your opponent through non-kinetic force. So that can be cyber, where you, you know, maybe use hacking or some kind of, you know, computational approach, information or psychological approaches, you know, where you mislead or exploit some vulnerability in their thinking process, or economic, where you deny them access to their bank account or things like that, where, you know, and that, those, you can build weaponry. And when you think about, you know, what sort of makes up a weapon, you have sort of two fundamental components, right? You've got a payload. So, you know, in a missile, that might be an explosive. And then you have a targeting system. And in non-kinetic approaches or informational warfare, your targeting system is an algorithm that uses data. And your payload delivery is information and cultural narratives.
So the structure of the weapon remains sort of the same.
It's a weapon. It's just, it doesn't blow you up. It just confuses you. It misleads you. It... You know, if we're looking at a sort of psychological approach, you know, or it might, you know, screw up your system so you can't actually, you know, use your computer, right? And one of the things that we started, you know, looking at is like, what, how can we use this data, this social media data, to start to really intricately understand certain target profiles? And one of our clients in the U.S. Air Force Cyber Command just happened to be on a plane, you know, flying in the United States, and how Americans do, they just chat with people around them. And the person that they were sitting beside was a political operative, a very sort of alt-right kind of person, or, you know, what we now call alt-right, then called the Tea Party. And so they just chatted about, you know, what do? You know, and at the end of that plane ride, our client gave my boss's cards to this political operative who happened to be somebody who works for Steve Bannon. And then Steve Bannon came into sort of, you know, we sort of found ourselves in the targets of Steve. And at the time, he was just like, this is before he was quote-unquote Steve Bannon, like the Steve Bannon. This is when he was just Steve Bannon, weird guy who runs this site called Breitbart. And when...
The good old days.
In the good old days, we had President Obama, if you can remember that. And when Andrew Breitbart, founded Breitbart, before he died and then Steve took over, he always said that politics exists downstream from culture. So if you want to make any change, focus on changing the culture, and politics will just flow from that. So Breitbart was created to be this big sort of big idea culture change type thing. It turned out to be a website that sort of, you know, was a hate blog for straight white dudes who can't get laid. Nope. And I say that, like, that's, I don't even say that
flippantly. You say that with data.
I say that with data. I mean, you know, if you haven't already, look up incels or involuntary celibates, which is what the alt-right calls straight white dudes who can't get laid, and therefore they hate women. And this is like an actual thing. I'm not exaggerating, this was a big part of the alt-right, guys who can't get laid. And so one of the problems with Breitbart is that it wasn't making the impact that, you know, it was envisioned to make. And so Steve, when he took over, and he wanted to fight this culture war, this war in culture, you know, he realized that he needed to expand his arsenal of weaponry. And like I was saying before, when you're fighting a war, you need an arsenal, and you start to think, what are those? What is that arsenal? And so when he discovered that there were companies that the military uses to do psychological operations or information operations, he's like, bingo, that's what I need. The problem was that we couldn't necessarily sell stuff because we were doing research for the military. So in the same way that, you know, if I'm making some new nuclear weapon, I can't just Joe come along and go, hey, I'd like to buy your nukes. And it's like, all right, here you go. You can't do that. So to sort of get around that, what happened was he being Steve, got one of his super alt-right pals, who happens to be a billionaire, a guy by the name of Robert Mercer, who made all of his money in, you know, becoming one of the first hedge funds that used algorithms in the 90s, PhD in computational linguistics. So he got all this data stuff to just go and acquire the company. And then what happened was, so we're working in this defense context, and then our management changes, our board changes, our shareholders change, everything changes. All of a sudden, this guy, Steve from America, is now like boss Steve. He's the boss man. And very soon after that, that's when, you know, the data that we were looking at that got, you know, accessed in by a team in Russia. Russians started coming in. We had all kinds of people getting put into the company that then wanted to start exploiting the research that we were doing with Americans. The people that we were setting out to defend became the targets. It wasn't just me. Like, a lot of people found that really problematic. The problem was that when you're, like, working in a company and all of a sudden, like, it gets bought and, like, it's starting to do criminal things, it's like you can't go to, like, HR and be like, can I, like, file, like, a complaint against the entire company for being criminal? Like, I'd like it on my, like, HR review that I dispute this. Yeah. You know, you can, you don't, it, you know.
Where's the HR department on Death Star?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. You are on the Death Star, and, you know, if you don't like Darth Vader and you go to HR, you know, you're going to get shot into the, you know, the vacuum of space, right? That's your resolution to the problem. You won't ever care about this again because you'll be floating in space. And so what happened was, kind of like that, getting ejected from the company and then getting sued for like eons constantly over random bullshit because when I left and then several other people left, they then kind of freaked out that I was going to, you know, report them, which I did. The problem is, when you're in Britain, like, you want to report some kind of crime or whatever, you have to go to the local, like, police station. Like, so it's like the same whether somebody stole some gum from you or, like, you know, just like, you know,
they have a cat in the tree. That's where you end
up.
Yeah,
you have a cat. Yeah, and so, you know, you go and you're like, all right, so hi, random policeman.
I fucked up the internet. So
it's like, all right, where do I begin? So we were like this military contractor, and then like this like super right wing guy got this like billionaire to buy us, and then like we were doing like this psychological warfare stuff with like ISIS, but now they're trying to do it in America, and then they like moved all the data to St. Petersburg in Russia, and I'm pretty sure like there's all these like security service agents,
and it sounds and, like you sort of cut down a bit on the
like,
asset kit.
And then and it's like, all right, well, on the forum I'll check other for the crime, and we'll file this and get back to you, right? And so, and you know, the
they would ask you not to smoke as much weed the next time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the problem was that everybody that I talked to, you know, I talked to people who at the time worked in the White House, and the response was, well, of course Donald Trump's like campaign team is shady. Like, he's a shady motherfucker. Like, he's a, you know, of course he's using, and yeah, sure, he's probably working with the Russians. That makes sense. We know that too. But Hillary Clinton's going to win. So we don't really want to see like seem like we're pushing the, you know, we're like we're interfering with the election. God forbid somebody interfered with the election. And it was only after, you know, after Trump got elected that people started getting interested in this weird, shady kind of company. And it was actually The Guardian investigating Brexit, which is how they found me, because in Brexit, there was this random company based on an island on the west coast of Canada called AIQ. And its website was just a phone number, and which went to an answering machine. And 40%, over 40% of Vote Leave spending, the official Leave campaign, went to this random company. And no one in Britain had heard of it, and they were trying to figure out, what is this like company? When you Google its address, it's like a random house on this island on the west coast of Canada. That seems shady.
So a phone answering machine on a Canadian island spends 40% of the Leave campaign budget.
Yeah, and that seems odd.
I agree, yeah.
But they couldn't find anything out about this company, because like, there was just nothing. And somebody at the Guardian just had the brilliant idea of just copying and pasting the number into Google, just like Googling the phone number. And what they found was the phone number was also the Canadian office of SCL Group, this military contractor. And they're like, oh, that's weird. There's a British military contractor that has the same phone number in Canada as AIQ. And then, so then they start looking into what is this SCL Group, and they're like, oh, wait, it's Cambridge Analytica. Oh, wait, maybe that's not legal, because also Leave EU is using Cambridge Analytica officially, then the Vote Leave campaign was using something that was part of Cambridge Analytica.
But is it still The Guardian to do, is it?
Was it The Guardian? So then anyway, they start investigating, and everybody's
sorry,
like...
Sorry, but how come no British agency says, who's funding these campaigns, some official agency?
Girl, you assume competence, you assume people care... You assume people know
sorry,
what they're
my bad.
Doing.
Go on.
Also, by the way, just as an FYI, in most countries, when you file for financial expenditures in an election, it's like 6 months after the election is finished, or the referendum in this case, right? So the attitude of the campaign was, meh, the referendum will be over by the time people find out, so whatever. Oh. And also, it was hidden quite... elegantly, where it was actually very difficult to unpack. Anyways, they talked to all these people, and they're like, oh, you need to talk to Chris. Like, he knows about that. Anyway, so finally they found me, and I was like, girl, you don't know the half of it. Like, it's not just like, this American company that was actually like working on both sides of the campaign. It's like, it goes so much deeper. There's like fucking Russians involved, like intelligence agencies, Palantir, this like company that was founded by the CIA that does all this like spying shit, like all the, and they're like, what? And like, I'm like, yeah. And like, here's the docs.
Yeah.
Because girl's got her receipts. So then they started looking into it, and they're like, oh my God, this is like going into weird intel directions, like the Russians. It's like all these like things. It goes to Africa. They hacked like the president of Nigeria. Like, and there's like all these like security agents everywhere. So
you
then
can imagine them
the
doing
New York
one of those
Times
war room, sort of pinpointing everything.
Oh, literally, it looked like a crazy person's room. Like, yeah. you know, in like, you know, it's sort of a Beautiful Mind type thing where it's just sort of like there's lots of things connecting to lots of things, and you look in and you're like, all right, like. Good luck with that. And so they brought in the New York Times. The New York Times is like, looks through the stuff, and they're like, all right, well, we validated this, but this still sounds fucking cray. And so that's when we brought on Channel 4 News, which is the other like lesser known but super cool public broadcaster in Britain that does sort of all the like quote unquote diversity edgy stuff that BBC doesn't do. And they do really good undercover operations. So then we planned, because essentially we were like, all right, this sounds like a really shit James Bond novel that you kind of probably don't want to watch, but like it sounds vaguely interesting. But we need to like...
We need to validate. I mean, as a journalist, to, like, I feel that...
It was validated, but it was validated in fucking emails. Like the emails are like contracts, and it's just like, it still doesn't... Like there's signatures and shit, like... It's all there, but it just still sounded crazy. So we then planned out this like undercover operation where we just let executives at Cambridge Analytica, you know, tell us what they do, and then they set it all on camera. it was at that point, and you know, the authorities knew that we were doing this.
And were you part of that team, sort of planning?
Yeah, we're planning the whole thing out. Yeah. Whole thing out. It's crazy when you're planning. Like, you have to like plan out, like, you know, like the waiters have cameras, the food on the other table is a camera, like the sandwich could be a camera. I don't know. You know, you could put a camera
in
there.
By the way,
you'd be amazed at what you can put cameras in. Like, my favorite one was because we got this Saudi company that apparently that's a big market for hidden cameras, and they had this like Starbucks cup, and it literally just looks like a Starbucks cup, and you could actually drink out of it, like you could drink coffee out of it, but it was a camera. Like, it was literally a camera, and it looked like, I was like, what? That's a camera? And he took off the lid, and he showed me the camera on the inside. I'm like, I was drinking out of that. He's like, yeah, but it was a camera. Anyway, we got all of this stuff. The authorities know this. They start planning on making a move on Cambridge Analytica. But then Facebook finds out, because we wanted to give Facebook extra time to respond to all the stuff that happened, because they authorized the application. You know, there's at least 87 million records of voters that were taken. That all went to Russia. In St. Petersburg, the team that was looking at that was also working for the Russian government. Yep. They were doing profiling work. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. And so then Facebook's like, the first thing that they do is they send a letter to The Guardian being like, we're going to sue you for defamation. Like, fuck the fuck off. And then they sent a letter to me because they're like, none of this is true. How dare you? And then same day, same lawyer sends me a letter going, all of this is true, but we're going to report you. And they didn't really think that, like, maybe I might walk over to The Guardian and be like, hey, Jill, who's the head lawyer. Hey, Jill, did you get a letter today from Facebook? And she's like, yeah, I did. And they're really angry. I'm like, yeah, I know. I got one too. Do you want to share? And she's like, okay. So we shared. And it was literally like, this is not true. This is all true. So obviously, you can't be entirely
untrue.
Why did
they tell you it's true? What's the point?
Well, so because they were threatening to take me to the FBI. Yeah. Now, they didn't realize that actually they were the subject of investigation. They were already under investigation by the authorities. And I was the primary witness in that. And then they just lied to The Guardian and said none of it's true. Now, when the CTO at the British Parliament was asked, why did you tell The Guardian that none of this was true and then start to take them to court? His response was, we just assume that's how we treat journalists. That we just threaten them with false allegations and just hope that they stop publishing. And he was like, yeah, that's our bad. Sorry, we'll try better. So then my lawyers, who are brilliant, by the way, everybody involved in this story is like a woman, except for me, when I'm not a queen. And because women are awesome and they, like, you know, don't mansplain shit and want to learn stuff. And anyway, so my lawyers, who are awesome, they call up Facebook. Like, so you want to report our clients to like the FBI? Have fun with that. By the way, you're actually the one under investigation. Then we get this letter from Facebook that's like, oh, so we sent you a form letter and we didn't appreciate the circumstances and we probably should have, quote, adjusted for tone and all that, you know. It's like, oh, sorry. So we didn't mean to threaten you with jail time.
Or we should have threatened you with jail time, but in a nicer tone.
Yeah. Yeah, we should have gently implied soft jail.
Which would be completely
gentle
cool.
Jail.
Gentle
you know, it's
jail.
Like the handcuffs with the fur on them.
That's the one, yeah.
And so, anyway.
So here's a new letter.
Yeah, so then they're like, oopsies. And so then the general counsel of Facebook, which is like the head lawyery dude of the company, gets involved because then it goes to like board level of Facebook and they start panicking or whatever. Anyway. Long story short, they don't actually like want our help because we were just like, do you want to, like, we're happy to tell you about the story. That's why, like, we gave you all this time. Like, do you want to talk about it? Because you're like, you're clearly really important in this. And then they just like stopped communications for a couple days. And then, anyway, on a Friday, the Friday before the story came out, so I go to bed and I get this like phone call. It's like at 3 a.m. And I'm looking, and it's, like, New York Times, and I just, like, go hang up. Like, don't answer, because, like, Americans sometimes don't quite understand that the world has different time zones, right? No. It's like, yeah.
They're bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but then it just keeps ringing. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, oh my God. Anyway, so I pick up and I'm like, girl, it is 3 a.m. You woke me up. Like, call me later. Matt Rosenberg, who's one of the national security correspondents for the New York Times, he's just sort of really like gruff but lovable guy. Like, and he's big and he like spent lots of years in Afghanistan, has all these like war stories about when he was in Afghanistan.
And now you're calling him girl.
And,
yeah.
And I call everyone girl. If I like you, I'll call you girl. And he's like, and he's like, and I'm like a bit not understanding what he's saying. He's like super angry. And I'm like, dude, like take a chill pill or whatever. Like just, and he's like, do you see what Facebook did? I'm like, no, I didn't see what Facebook did. It's like fucking 3 a.m. I'm literally in bed. Literally, it's pitch black. And I'm lying in bed, like in my underwear, just like talking to the New York Times. And then I hear people yelling in the background. And he's like, they're trying to fuck the whole thing. And I'm like, what? Anyway, so I go and then I see like I'm banned on Facebook. And I was like, lol, well, okay, fine. I don't really use Facebook, but okay, cool. I'm banned. And then they try to leak the story, or rather a very particularly misleading aspect of the story to some of the competitors to New York Times and Guardian. Because I guess they thought that that was a good idea. And so anyway, so he's super mad. And then it's like, well, I don't know like what to do. You should probably call the Guardian or whatever. Like, I'm not in charge. I'm just the guy who said stuff, right? So they then proceed to wake up all the editors of the Guardian at 3 a.m. to walk into the Guardian to change the newspaper. And then they also had to call Channel 4. Now, Channel 4 is responsible in the UK for broadcasting the Paralympics. So Channel 4 then had to get permission to cancel the Paralympics to move the story to that day and do that at, you know, like 4 a.m. And try to explain, you know, like we need to cancel.
So you screwed up the internet and the Paralympics.
So yeah. So anyway, so long story short, if you want to piss off everyone in the global media, do that. That's a great strategy. If that's your objective, do that. Later that day, then some of the members of parliament who I was working with on the parliamentary side of the inquiry, they found out, they were super pissed off. Like the idea that this company can just unilaterally ban a whistleblower. So then they called an emergency debate on Monday at Parliament. So then there was a debate about my ban. So literally, like, I'm watching, like, questions in Parliament about me being banned by Facebook, and then the Secretary of State responsible, standing up on behalf of Her Majesty's government, issuing a statement saying what Facebook has done is, quote, outrageous. And that it's outrageous because what happened was, so my Facebook stopped working, obviously, but then like I didn't really care. I was like, okay, whatever. Like I don't barely even fucking use Facebook. Like whatever. But then I tried to go on Instagram because you know I needed my daily dose of you know well curated avocado toast and thirst pics of abs and yep. Hot people. And then that didn't work. And I was like, oh, weird. And then I'm like, oh right, because they own Instagram. Oh yeah. And then my WhatsApp didn't work. And then I tried to go on Tinder, but because I used single sign-on with Facebook, my Tinder stopped working, so I deleted all my dates.
And now, now it's getting painful.
Then it was, like, painful. Yeah. And then all my apps stopped working. And then I was like, what? I literally don't exist anymore. Like, it's crazy. I got deleted. Literally deleted. And then when my friends tried to look up, like, old, like, combos on, like, Facebook chat and stuff, it just, like, nothing, it just, I was gone. Like, it's not even my old chats. It's just, like, I literally was eviscerated. And what was so sort of offensive about that, and this was sort of discussed at Parliament, was, like, a company, without any due process, can exert this amount of power so intimately on someone's life. And what happens, and if this is what they're allowed to do right now, what happens if they decide to exert that force in a broader sense? That's potentially dangerous, that we allow a company to have that right. And so anyway,
this is a perfect bridge to my question. So yeah. You'll have a bit of the Queen's champagne, and I'll talk for a second.
I'll drink some of the Queen's champagne.
To me, it seems like we today as a society have this uncertain relationship with personal data, let's call it that. We know there's a lot of data available about each and every one of us, but we're having trouble understanding what that really means. And my theory is that we only consider them on a piece by piece level, sort of that I might submit my name or my zip code, my MasterCard number and whatnot. And they don't seem to contain that much information all by themselves, these pieces. Yeah. But then when you combine them, they might say a whole lot about you. And to try to use an analogy here, it's like we would consider each piece of furniture in a room, but would not get the idea that together they will tell a lot about us.
Aesthetic and concept, if you will.
Exactly. So that abstract data might have a very tangible impact on your life when combined. Mm. Is that how you would describe it as well?
So, imagine for a second we're going on a blind date. All right. So, lucky you. I don't know how we met because my Tinder doesn't work. So anyway,
data blind date.
Yeah, we're doing some kind of old school whatever.
Yeah.
Cheers. Yes. Oh, you've got my favorite champagne. Look at that. You know so much.
I had someone tell you that's your favorite champagne. Yeah.
So now we're going on a blind date. You don't know anything about me. You don't know who I am. Okay. You don't know my name. You've never seen me before. We sit down, right? Okay, let's say for a second that we're on a blind date and actually I know everything about you. I have access to your playlist. I know what you're listening to on your, taxi ride to the restaurant. I listen to all your conversations with your friends, with your parents, with your ex. I read all your text messages. I looked at, what school you went to, what grades you got. Everything. I know everything about you, right?
I would probably be flattered because that's who I am.
Great. Now, you don't know anything about me, right? And so what are the questions that you ask on a first date? It's usually what kind of music do you listen to? Or what movies do you like? Do you play any sports? Seemingly innocuous questions, but these are questions that help us build the profile of who you are. If I go, I like the following bands in this sequential order, and I like these, whatever films I like, I play these sports, and you're like, wow, you're perfect. That's exactly what I do, right? Would you feel comfortable in that situation? Could you properly assess why am I saying this? Because in that situation, you don't necessarily know if I'm saying this because I'm being genuine or I'm saying this because I know what you want to hear. And the thing about online advertising is kind of like that situation where you don't even know how much I know, right? And imagine we went on a date and you're like, oh, wow, this guy's perfect. He knows, he just loves everything that I love. And then I'm like, why don't you come back to my flat, right?
Yep.
Let's get a little bit more cozy, as Swedish people would say. Then there's a question of, are you consenting to that situation, right? Are you consenting to what I've told you? Or are you consenting to me? And so if you take online advertising, it is very much like that. In information operations, to get back to the military, what you call that situation is a situation of informational asymmetry.
Yep.
I can exert more influence and power over you because I have so much more information about you in my arsenal to use. You don't know anything about me. And when you think about a lot of, online advertising networks or social platforms, they know lots about you. You don't know much about them. You don't know what they know about you. When you see stuff, you don't know necessarily why you're seeing that. And you go through the internet and it seems kind of random and it seems, you don't necessarily see the intentionality behind it, but there is. And I think one of the problems is we don't ask questions about, what are the ethics of doing that? My concern is when you look at, for example, all this fucking bullshit about you look at the language that Silicon Valley uses, right? They talk about, user experience rather than addictive design, right? They talk about your data, they call data exhaust, or breadcrumbs, as if they're picking up waste products. Your identity, who you are, is a waste product that they're just recycling, right? And they have all these sort of words and euphemisms that I find really problematic because, you look at, you know, Instagram or like any kind of social platform, really, and you look at the, like, you know, how the it's now swipey, right? You just continue to swipe, right? So there's this thing called ludic loops, which are the precursor to gambling addiction. So if you imagine a slot machine, right, doing this, where a repetitive task giving you an occasional reward can put you at risk of becoming addicted. And this is documented in addictions research, and you look at user experience, is what they call it, UX design, you know, and they measure engagement. What the fuck is engagement, right? It's you constantly using something. There's no innate good, but they always talk about it as if there's like this innate, you know, quality to engagement. The problem that I have is that when we look at the trends of where technology is going, and we look at all these little things and bits and pieces, as you're talking about, like the sort of, we're looking at the chair, we're looking at the sofa, but we're not looking at the big sort of picture. And, you know, we're now, you know, exploring self-driving cars. We're now putting Alexa into our homes. Mm. You know, we're now putting the sort of precursors to sort of systemic AI into our physical space. And what happens when all of these little pieces of furniture, so to speak, this AI, you know, where your living room watches you and thinks about you, and your refrigerator thinks about you, and your children's toys think about your kids and watch you watching your kids and start talking to your toilet, and your toilet talks to your car, and your car talks to the road, and the road talks to your boss, who's now a piece of AI, right? And they all start making decisions about you and for you, where you don't even, you're not even aware of what those decisions are, because you're inside of an ambient system that's constantly looking at you. And again, where it can see you, but you can't see it. It can make decisions about you, but you can't make decisions about it. And so, the problem that I see is, like, what does it mean for, you know, making choices as a person, exercising your ability to make a free choice, when where for the first time in human history, the environment itself thinks about you, right? We talk about God, we talk about spirits, we talk about all kinds of things playing an influence on people's lives, but like we're literally about to create that.
And my problem with this is, to use your analogy, is that a lot of the programmers, such as yourself sometimes, talk about this like they are just architects of a casino, where they are they're just doing their job, and the job is to get people to stay in the casino with the slot machines as long as possible. And they sort of remove themselves from the bigger concepts.
And that's a real problem. I think that's a problem in education, but it really highlights the degree at which privilege plays a role in engineering and software architecture, because it's very easy for people to say, well, they decided to come into my casino, right? It's very easy to sit there as like a white dude who makes lots of money to say, well, they made a choice, they didn't have to do that, right? You know, and being able to sort of ignore the fact that, you know, the environment and society and your history exerts a huge amount of force on your ability to actually exercise choices. You know, you tell a job seeker, don't use LinkedIn if you want to, you know, or don't use Google. How can you get a job if you go to an employer and say, I'd really love this job, I'm super talented, we'll like do great work together, but I don't want to use any Google products because I want like to exercise my right to privacy. Right? You're not going to get hired. Right? So is that a real choice? Are you really opting in? So one of the problems, I think, within software engineering in general is like engineers are not taught to think about some of the dynamics and the forces at play when people make a quote-unquote choice. That's not actually a choice.
No, and also the fact that we talk about this as technology all the time, and something that is technology that can be fixed, and that is probably a technological solution that we're looking for. I think that one of the great myths we have dealing with is that sort of, oh, the internet is broken, oh, the social media isn't working the way we thought they would work.
So let's engineer it. Yeah.
Where in fact,
it's very arrogant.
Where they work precisely the way we intended to. Mm. The algorithms are even better than we anticipated. And how do you fix something that isn't broken?
Yeah.
something I found fascinating is you coming from the fashion background, and sort of again referring back to Breitbart about sort of politics is downstream from culture, and how that affects people. And so I was thinking, when I mean, you, the first time you met Steve Bannon, what did you make of how sort of how did you decode him?
Oh well, I mean, a hot mess, but not hot. So just a mess. So like he does this thing, and I didn't know why. I still don't really know why he sometimes wears multiple shirts at once.
Yep.
But not like in like a statement-y kind of way. In a like I forgot that when I wake up I have to take off my old clothes kind of way, and I just put on. I keep compiling shirts until there's like, you know, an Elizabethan collar of sort of collars coming out the what, like literally he takes like Oxford shirts and puts several on top of each other. It was really weird, and then like could see it collected dandruff. It was really gross. Anyway, but aside from that, the when I first met him, he was literally, he was Steve from America. So like I know I, you know, and one of the things that came to appreciate is like when you work at a military contractor, you meet some really fucking weird people. Like, that's normal. So it's like some dude who's like called Steve from America, and you're like,
a normal,
okay,
weird guy.
You're like, yeah. And I'm like, all right, quote unquote, Steve from America, you can ask me questions and like I'll guess which agency you're actually from, and you're, we'll play this weird game where you can't say what you're from and you're assessing something or other. The questions that he asked were actually really interesting when I first met him. Like, what do you think culture is? Why do you think culture changes? Could you measure culture? And I was like, oh my God, this is like great. All right, girl, sit down. We're going to talk about culture. And like,
so was he the first one who understood you? I mean, because you two seemed like a very unlikely match.
I don't know if he understood me or whether he was just, I've come to appreciate I was a tool. So is that an understanding? Is that empathy? Is that just like psychopathy? Because it actually is classic psychopathy to look at you and go, you can be an extension of my will.
Yeah.
I want you. I don't know. But we talked about, one of the things that we talked about, as I said, like, well, you can look at culture in lots of different ways. One of the things that I find interesting is the fact that, you know, we use, when you think about like describing different cultures or what people are like in different countries, right? And if, even if you indulge in a bit of, you know, light stereotyping and you go, what are Italians like compared to Germans, right? And you go, okay, maybe Italians are like more passionate or outgoing or extrovert or whatever, and Germans are more, you know, orderly and they plan and they're good at engineering and they make things like the Autobahn. Obviously, there's like Germans who don't fit within that, and there's Italians who don't fit within that. But kind of what you're describing is like, you know, a distribution. Generally, there's like people like this, and generally, there's people like that. And that what I found interesting, and was one of the things that I was looking at when I told him, is I said, look, a lot of the same words that we use to describe cultures are the same words that we use to describe people. You know, you can almost personify Italy as a person. Because ultimately, culture is composed of people. So it's people behaving as people, and culture emerges from that. And that if people are in some way units of culture, whether they are the sole units or an aspect of units of culture, and we can measure people, and we know that we can measure people because the work that we were doing prior was looking at like the relationships between certain psychological facets of people and the data that they sort of spew out when they go about their business on the internet, that perhaps then culture can be quantified. And if you can quantify culture through the quantification of people, then actually your question about how do you change culture becomes one of pushing a distribution one way or the other. And when you push that distribution one way or the other, you can literally translate that deviation down to like actual lists of people who would fall within that necessary movement. Yep. And for him, that was, I think, quite eye-opening, because I think what happened was, for the first time, somebody kind of explains, like, this is how you would do this culture change thing that you're interested in doing.
But you were also able to provide it to him by combining huge data sets that would say that if you like the Croc website, and you have ugly shoes, then you're probably a Trump supporter.
Yes.
Fairly simplified.
That's right? A very simplified version. Yeah. I mean, I've said before, I look at Trump in the same way that I look at Crocs.
Yeah.
A mistake. But if you think about Crocs, you know, prior to Crocs being popular, they were ugly, right? And I say this knowing full well that I'm wearing ugly sneakers right now because they're on trend. But they were ugly, right? And so if you ask somebody in 1975 to wear Crocs, they'd be like, hell no, what the fuck is that? It looks like a fucking beach pail with holes in it. My toe might get cut off. Like, no. And then at some point, enough people experiment with this thing where they build up a critical mass, and then people start wearing it, normal, regular people start wearing it, and make this terrible aesthetic mistake where they're wearing something that's like a faux shoe. And then at some point, people come to their senses and realize this is stupid. They stop wearing it, and then they look back on photos of them wearing it, and they cringe and go, what the fuck was I wearing? I mean, how many times have people actually had that moment where you look back like 5 years, 10 years ago, and you're like, ooh, what was that? That was a mistake. And to me, Donald Trump is like that. He is, in the same way that the Croc is the mockery of what a shoe is, he is a mockery of what a president is. And at some point, people thought it would be a good idea to engage with this bullshit. And they will then have to look back and go, that was a mistake. That was stupid.
But still, the powerful thing about big data, if I understand you right here, is also the fact that you don't make that judgment when we combine big data set to say, okay, people like the Crocs and they like Trump. I don't know why and I don't care. Obviously, there's a connection here. That's why we use big data and big science, and then
yeah. But
it,
I think some of the power. So that's what you call black boxing it,
yeah.
Where it's like there's some relationships. There's also like a relationship between liking curly fries on Facebook and intelligence. It's true, but the reason. But and if you black box it, you're like, all right, you like curly fries, so you're clearly smarter, right? The reason actually is because the page was started by a Harvard professor. Who invited other Harvard professors, who invited like other professors. And so weirdly, this group, not because curly fries signal intelligence, but because of how the page got founded,
yep.
Attracted more intelligent people. Understanding that dynamic is actually quite important. One of the things before I left that I found really interesting when I started reviewing some of the footage of like focus groups or, you know, online panels and things like that, that they were doing with like these sort of straight white dudes who can't get laid, the incels, the involuntary celibates, was how they felt like they felt like they couldn't express or be who they were, and they sort of blamed feminism and all this kind of stuff for it. And one of the things that I realized is that when you look at, for example, I don't know if people have seen like a Tea Party rally, but like the flag of the Tea Party is this like flag that has like this snake on it and it says, don't tread on me. Like, don't get in my way. And then one of the things that I started to notice and other people started to notice, because there's a lot of like gays working on the project before it got super alt-righty, was that these people were talking about how the feminists are making them feel closeted. And then you look at like a gay pride rally and you look at a Tea Party rally, and it's like a Tea Party rally is just the same message without the glitter. It's like, let me be who I want to be. Now, who you want to be is a disgusting person.
Nope.
You know, and the reason you can't get laid is because like you're a terrible human being. Mm-mm. But the message is the same, and the feeling of being closeted is the same. And that's a very powerful feeling. And so I think one of the things that the company got right when they were doing research is to start to tap into like, oh, these highly privileged straight white dudes can't get laid. This makes them feel closeted. That makes them feel really angry. And they have all this pent-up anger, and that can be exploited.
Okay, I have two things here I wanted to say. First of all, I think that's a sort of a symbol of how we blame technology, because it's easier to blame technology, Facebook, Instagram, or whatever, rather than taking responsibility for ourselves, because we are in this confirmation bias filter bubbles,
yeah,
where we look upon the world. Sort of.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the progressives are, you know, there's a lot of fault on progressives.
Exactly. The filter bubbles did not help Trump win, but they can explain why so many people in the progressive didn't
ignored
see him coming.
It. Yeah. And ignored people who genuinely need help. You know, the other thing that I really realize is that a lot of people who are racist, no one's born racist. Like, there's no like racist baby. It's not like, you know, like little Hitler babies like destined to like, you know, hate everyone. People in pain usually are the ones who are most hateful. And often that pain is, you know, I've been systemically unemployed, or I feel like I'm not living up to a particular promise or potential that I thought that I could. And one of the interesting things is like the number of times I've seen people who profess to be like people who wanted to stand up for, you know, people in bad situations, you know, people who are unemployed or people who don't have the same kinds of advantages that other people do, point fingers at people who don't have the privilege of education, who can't express themselves well, who don't have jobs, and go, look at these rednecks, look at these hicks. You know, I think that in the United States, Democrats did that. I think in Brexit, Remainers did that, where it's like, and they still do, it's, you know, these people, they don't know what they're talking about. Yep. So, like, you know, let's blame them. Not recognize that when you talk with fancy words with your Oxford degree, you are speaking with privilege.
Yep.
And not recognizing that your understanding of everything is a privilege.
And you can have the same here in Sweden, where we talk about the far-right Swedish Democrats from the progressive that talk about with the same kind of contempt, rather than trying to understand where they're coming from or trying to understand their pain sometimes. And I think that also...
And sometimes it's misplaced pain, but sitting, you know, having spent many conversations with abject racists and people who have really hateful views, and listening, and it's not easy to do, but listening with patience and being open and ironically creating a safe space, weirdly, to be racist, that you learn a lot. And that one of the things that I've learned is, like, progressives do not understand privilege. They really don't, because they recognize certain privileges and completely discount others. Education is one of them. You know, income is one of them. Class is one of them. Not speaking with a particular diction, not speaking with a complex understanding of the world, it is frowned upon, even though that is the only way you can do that is because you had the benefit of going to university and having an education.
Yeah, and that will come back to the second point I wanted to stress. And then as I feel that also the automatic algorithm, they drive segregation, yes, on social media, but or they also reflect...
It is segregation, and that's, it's not just segmentation, it's segregation.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that segregation that we have online in social media and that's driving that is what we have the segregation offline. We have we are self-segregating.
Yeah.
We are staying in our neighborhoods.
I had so many conversations at Congress with these one-on-one conversations with members of Congress where, you know, they would say, what's the big deal? This is just about ads. I don't get it, right? And you talk to somebody, I won't name who it was, but this person was involved in the civil rights movement in the United States. And, you know, and he goes, I don't get it. It's just some ads. Why is this a big deal? And I said, well, why is it a big deal to sit on a bus? Why is it a big deal to use a water fountain? Why is it a big deal to go to a movie theater? There was an entire movement in the United States to desegregate, to put people in the same space. Segregation, one of the biggest faults of segregation, the biggest harms of segregation is that when you remove people from common space and common experience, that's when they become the other. And when somebody becomes the other, they, you know, are at risk of becoming not a person. And then it's very easy to, you know, commit atrocious harms. And that what we're doing online through personalization, through segmentation, is you know, we spent years trying to desegregate schools, desegregate public spaces, and now where people collect information, where people learn about what's happening in the world is being re-segmented and segregated. And the harm that could come from that, I think, is huge. Where if we no longer live in the same realities and your reality is different from mine, we can't even have a conversation because we can't even agree on what's real. Like, I feel like there's a real harm that could come from that. And just because we might be on the same street together doesn't mean that we live in the same world together. And that's like, you know, a next level of segregation. All of the progress that has been made over the past 30 years in the United States, I feel like could be eroded because of this. Mm. And that's why we should care about it. That if you cared about segregation of schools or theaters, you should care about the segregation of the internet.
What would you say that you guys at Cambridge Analytica exploited, really? I mean, data is one thing, but there's something else here we're talking about. It's the exploitation of cultural narrative, of toxic masculinity, of...
Yeah. And empathy.
Feelings of shame, yeah, I mean...
Part of it was weaponized empathy, because...
What do you mean by that?
Well, empathy is the ability to understand how someone is feeling. Normally that's talked about in a good way. It's like you can understand somebody so you can relate to them better. But also, empathy allows you to manipulate in a more effective way. And so, you know, when you looked at...
Going back to that date, when you were exploiting your date.
Yes. And so, you know, when you looked at, for example, how Hillary Clinton's campaign team, they just used old data sets to anticipate turnout, looking at the past couple of elections for turnout, to estimate turnout, not ever asking the question, was the past couple of elections where Obama was president actually the exception to the rule, not the rule? And not actually going out to places like Michigan and talking to people, developing theories, then testing those theories. And I think CA was better at...
They misjudged Barack Obama for being the new normal, where in fact he was not.
They didn't... This is what I mean about like the arrogance of progressive people, is that it's like if you go in going, I own empathy, I own underprivileged people, I own all of these things, I understand it, therefore I am not going to test my assumptions, you're going to make mistakes. And you know, the thing that Cambridge Analytica did is that it went in trying to test things.
No.
And it got a much better feel of the American population than I think the Democrats did, because it wasn't arrogant.
So just because we have a...
Just because you want to help doesn't mean that you actually know what the fuck you're doing.
Just because we don't have a gay pride in Stockholm doesn't mean that we can sort of shelf the things about gay LGBTQ rights. That's dumb.
Yeah. Well, and also just because you think of yourself as a, you know, well-meaning, well-rounded person doesn't mean that you're, you know, not... you know, discriminatory in other ways. One of the things that, you know, you notice about a lot of progressive people is they talk about underprivileged people, but then when you ask them, when was the last time you hung out with somebody that didn't have a university degree? When was the last time you talked with your cab driver? When was the last time you went to a council estate, you know, and talked to somebody on social welfare and hang out and like have a drink with them? Do you actually know these people that you profess to represent? Probably not.
And instead of seeing sort of the information asymmetry you're talking about, it's about information deficit. And so we're trying to get these people more
information. But it's the worst kind of information deficit, because it's the kind of information deficit where you don't know what you don't know. Right? It's not like there's an understanding of that gap. It's a super blind spot, because you don't even know what you don't know. Because you think you know it, but you don't.
Changing tracks slightly, after Cambridge Analytica, you've returned to the fashion bubble, applying your skills in combining big data to optimize your business. You're now at the H&M Group. Tell us what you do there.
We are looking at ways of engaging people. We're looking at ways of anticipating fashion trends. And what's really cool about that is that when you look at fast fashion and the amount of waste that exists in fast fashion, partly because there's a mismatch between supply and demand, that if we're able to better match our supply and our product without demands and reduce the amount of products that don't sell and get thrown out, we're able to make a dramatic impact on our carbon emissions, which is super cool. So, like, what's really neat about working with H&M is that we're able to, like, actually make an impact. Like, we're so big that we can actually make an impact on not only our environmental footprint, but also exert pressure on the rest of the industry to follow suit.
And they've always been very data conscious and data driven, right?
I mean, data, I think, for the fashion industry at large has come, so the sort of awareness of what you can do with it has come later than, say, like finance. But I know that the company is like really keen to take its what it currently knows about the market and try to apply it to make better things. And the really cool thing about fashion is, like, not only, you know, by reducing waste, we can reduce, you know, carbon emissions and all that, but, like, I think people underestimate the power of, like, that sort of every morning people wake up and decide what to wear. And if we can make things that make people feel better about themselves and feel more confident, like, the sort of holistic impact that we can make on people, I think, is significant. Making people feel better about themselves is, like, a really cool task.
Yeah. But they could also be a bunch of buzzwords. How, I mean, how do you go about doing that in your sort of when you get to work tomorrow?
In terms of how do we understand what people want, or how
what they want,
wear
and also
things,
how
they
feel better about themselves? Is it about providing them data that at the H&M Group we do this and this with sustainability, or is it about helping people? Are you involved in sort of designing stuff differently based on data? Or?
Yeah, I think also taking a different mindset to start with customers first, always start with people, and what is it that is going to, you know. And the other thing too is that it's not just, you know, asking a customer what do they want and then flogging it to them. It's looking at the entire journey of that product. Like, when they wear it, does it actually fit well? You know, people don't necessarily know enough about all the intricacies of clothing to better to say, like, exactly what it is that they want. They just want it to be right. Yep. And so start to look at, like, does it fit well? Does it last? Like, is this actually something that is going to make someone look good?
Yep.
And feel good? And the really cool thing that I find about this company is that, like, every single meeting that I have, are we helping people feel good? Are we helping people look good? And also, are we doing what we can to start to reduce our impacts on the environment? Comes up in every single meeting, even if sustainability is not on the agenda, if people's, you know, well-being is not on the agenda, it comes up in every single meeting. And I really, that's a very unique attitude and internal culture that I haven't seen in other companies, which I mesh with well.
So you don't miss politics, given the fact that you sort of move more upstream?
I think that you can make as much of an impact, if not more, in fashion than in politics. Because you put on clothes every single day. Clothes represent things. Clothes are powerful. When you look at, you know, any kind of political movement, major political movement throughout history, you know, you can picture what, you know, a Maoist in you know, communist China looks like, or what a Nazi looks like, or what any kind of, what ISIS fighters look like. Clothing is a really powerful symbol. And so often, as the examples that I just gave, are things that end up harming people. But on the flip side, I think that we can use fashion to open up conversations with people and get people to start thinking about stuff as a vehicle of positive social change. So H&M really does take its role in society seriously. Which I think is actually unique in the fashion sector,
and also in a peaceful way.
In a peaceful, in a very peaceful way.
Thank you so much, Chris, for talking to me.
Cheers. Thank you for having me.
That was Christopher Wiley, and I thought it was very fun and an informative conversation to have. Now, as a bonus, you'll hear an excerpt from my book, The Big Bubble, that you'll find as an ebook or printed copy wherever you find English books in your part of the world. Before that, I should also say that this episode of Perspectives was produced by Gabriel Lahti and is done by VVV Media in collaboration with Acast. Now, here's an excerpt from The Big Bubble. Introduction. Being well informed is especially important if you have the power to unleash fire and fury upon another nation with the intent of totally destroying that nation. Which is why the President of the United States is receiving a daily brief containing important and classified documents early each morning, irrespective of where in the world he might be. One of the folders included in the daily brief contains the latest analysis of issues related to national security and global conflicts from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Another folder contains documents with background information on the day's meetings, who is to be involved, and any topics likely to be raised. A third folder contains a summary of public opinion and press clippings exemplifying how the president and the agenda he's pursuing are currently being portrayed in the media. The purpose of these folders is to offer the president a complete overview of the situation at home and abroad, based on robust documentation, so that he or she is able to make balanced decisions with the nation's best interest at heart. Naturally, different presidents have had varying wishes as to what could be included in the brief and how often it should be presented. John F. Kennedy preferred the concise briefing in a format that allowed him to carry the most essential information in the inner pocket of his jacket. George W. Bush did not want to be briefed on Sundays. Barack Obama liked to receive all folders and information digitally. Donald Trump has his own opinions about the content of the briefing folders itself. He only wants positive news. White House staff is, therefore, tasked with sorting through the media stream to identify the most positive reports of the president and his politics. The task is to find 20 to 30 items twice a day. The content is a mixture of positive assertments from TV morning show hosts, admiring tweets, articles reprinting favorable quotes about the president from people on the street, appreciative social media posts, homages in a conservative or right-wing press, and the occasional image of Mr. Trump looking imposing in a television appearance. On days when positive news is thin on the ground, staff in charge of putting together a folder has been known for wandering about the White House in search of favorable images of the president for inclusion in what is now known as the propaganda folder. The purpose of this folder is to keep the famously ill-tempered and egocentric president in good spirits by enabling him to maintain a distorted image of himself and the world. How do you go about obtaining a correct image of the world anyway? One way is to follow public discourse to see what various pundits think about current events. And if you're like me, this means that you read a newspaper or use a news app on your phone. You may scroll through what we people are saying on Twitter or your feed on Facebook. Listening to the argument of both sides in a debate is, however, not the same as understanding what is true and what's not. If person A claims climate change is a man-made and person B claims it's not, the truth is not somewhere in between. Besides that, what you're getting in your feed might only be voices that sound like person B, declaring that the talk of climate change is exaggerated or that it's all a conspiracy by the left. During the election campaign, the difficulty in getting an objective view of the world was particularly demanding. Partisan news and targeted ads only confirm what supporters of a particular candidate or political party already believe to be true and reinforce the biases of their opponents. All sides seem to convey an image of the other side as a group of people that was always providing an exaggerated or false view of reality. One used to be able to rely on media to get an objective view of the world. Being impartial is what journalism is supposed to be about. Even if some media chose to lean to the left and others to the right, they would share the same basic approach to the craft. An editor might choose to tell a story from a particular angle, but they would remain impartial doing so in order to avoid being seen as a propaganda tool for one party. Impartiality is a basic tenet of journalism. There are media outlets that occupy a position more to the right or left in their attitudes to the world and to power, but they still have the same basic approach to the craft. Even if the editor chooses to a certain angle to a news story, they will attempt to avoid picking sides, being perceived as biased or appearing to propagandize for one view or one point or the other. Truthfulness, accuracy, objectivity, impartiality, fairness and public accountability has been a part of the journalistic creed for more than a century. The opinions of both sides in conflict should be reported, and the reader, listener, viewer should always be able to trust the facts. By comparing how different media outlets report an event, you can see whether a news story is true, several reports independently stating the same basic facts, or obtain a somewhat more in-depth understanding of what has occurred, thanks to the various angles of the outlets have chosen to adopt. At least, that's what it used to be like. Over the course of a few decades, the public trust in media has slowly deteriorated. Accusations of media withholding information or refraining to report some news as a result of political motives have been more common in recent years. Some media outlets have even publicly accused of publishing news that are completely made up in order to help one party advance their political agenda. For the average reader, listener or viewer, it's not easy to discern whether a story is correct. Some guidance is available, such as giving due consideration to who has published the story. But to complicate things, news might be published on news sites that appear confusingly similar to highly reliable news sources, but which are actually faked for the sole purpose of fooling visitors into believing one thing or the other, and then disseminating it. One method of checking the facts, in the past and in theory at least, is by using an encyclopedia. Nowadays we Google instead. Search engines, as we all know, work quite differently from an encyclopedia. The results displayed when you search are not sorted based on their veracity, but rather on their relevance. More precisely, what others searching for the same thing considered to be relevant to them. If the question is a simple one, such as, who is the current president of the United States? The answer is generally correct. If the question is more complicated, such as whether or not Donald Trump is considered to be a good president, there will seldom be a uniform answer, which makes it difficult to check whether something is true or false. In addition, it's often said that Google adapts its search results to the individual user, making the work of fact-checking even harder, as the answer depends on who you're asking. If you're like me, and many others, you will obtain a great deal of your news via Facebook. Mixed with updates from friends and acquaintances, you will find links to news that are currently engaging people the most. Once upon a time, Facebook was just an app among many others on your phone. Today is a political and cultural force with worldwide influence, and for many people, the effects of this change first became apparent in conjunction with the US presidential election in 2016. When the companies that created a platform we call social media talk about users, they are prone to rhetoric. Users are members and are described as being part of a digital community. When these companies first appeared, they promised to provide platforms unparalleled in human history. A forum where all stakeholders, citizens, politicians, media, NGOs and businesses alike should be able to congregate and discuss the issues closer to hearts. In this new public sphere, the lonely were to find soulmates, engagement was to be born and flourish, all voices were to be heard and given a chance to participate in a common discussion about the things that mean something to them. It felt like this kind of a new kind of freedom, and the social media platform seemed to deliver what they promised. But in reality, this was never anything but a commercial opportunity. Companies behaved like liberal thinkers and used language reminiscent of democratic institutions, despite the fact that they determined all of the rules. To behave like a quasi-state may sound cynical, but cynicism is not an adequate explanation for how the current state of affairs came to be. This is not a trait that I've come across particularly often among entrepreneurs during the almost 20 years I've been closely following the development of different digital services. It is, however, common to harbor a naive belief in the digitalization of society as solely a positive development for citizens. Of course, in many cases, users have proved to be equally starry-eyed. During the development phase of these privacy-owned digital societies, the images of the platforms as tools enhancing democracy have served corporations well. It's easier for users to share large parts of their private life with the business that lives by capitalizing the user's data if they believe that the companies is something more. All these large online platforms have grown, therefore influencing an ever-increasing proportion of the public sphere. The influence over that sphere, both positive and negative, have become more obvious. Nowadays, it's meaningless to divide reality into physical and the virtual. The digitalization of everyday processes have fused these together. Atoms and bits occur, helter-skelter. Digitalization has resulted in what was once static becoming elastic. often adapted to whoever is using it. The intention was good. The optimistic view of the effects is often extremely naive. As an example, it sounds handy that news services customize and filter content based on user preferences, but the effect is simultaneously to reduce our ability to mentally collate a folder of news clippings when we want to obtain a true picture of reality. Like it or not, technology is making it harder to understand the world as it creates a big bubble around us. This book is an attempt to map how manipulative algorithms, constrictive filter bubbles and fake news have made it harder than ever to cut through the crap and gain a well-founded factual understanding of the times in which we live. However, it's not impossible. This book will help you decode the digital media we take for granted, beginning at the source. By understanding the logic that structures the source code, that controls the algorithm that create the filter bubbles that seem to make it so difficult for us to separate fake news from real. By understanding how media are engaged, we can also learn how they engineer our worldview and, thus, how we can act to counteract their intrusion, for example, by learning the basic of source evaluation. And in the final part of the book, I summarize some of the options available to cut through the static, construct an accurate worldview, and avoid being trapped in a bubble. Algorithms, filter bubbles, and fake news. In order to obtain new knowledge, we must trust in others who know more. Human knowledge is essentially social. This means that the more people we have contact with, the more likely we are to obtain new knowledge. From a historical perspective, people in general have always benefited from as many people as possible having a forum to share the knowledge. The flip side of the democratization of the public sphere that the internet has contributed to is that it becomes difficult to decide who has useful knowledge and who is peddling falsehoods, whether accidentally or deliberately. In order to assist the users in navigating the broad but fragmented information stream, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and many other companies use algorithms. Algorithm is simply a fancy way of describing an equation that takes into consideration a number of factors in order to present a certain result. When you look at your Facebook feed, you will find posts from friends that appear to be random. However, the composition is actually a selection made by an algorithm. An algorithm that guesses which of all your friends' posts are the most relevant to you and prioritizes them in order of that information. Many news sites do exactly the same thing, adopting the front page to the preference of the visitor. Algorithms have learned that I have little or no interest in sports, because I never click on links to sport-related articles, and therefore sports news is rarely shown in my feed. I do, however, occasionally see articles linked to horse show jumping, as I have a friend who is an accomplished equestrian, and I obviously read articles about him. Another parameter is that social media algorithms prioritize posts linked to those we have a close social relationship with. In their haste to compile feeds that are as relevant as possible, algorithms filter out everything we appear to dislike until we are surrounded solely by things that we in all likelihood enjoy and want to read. This is true for topics as well as for sources. If you read the New York Times, you will see more articles from that source versus other sources, such as Fox News. The effect is that we are left in a filter bubble in which we see only confirmation of what we already believe. In addition, this big bubble grows ever more constrictive over time as the algorithms, by showing us only the things we like, and narrows results further. Everything else is filtered out. The result is an echo chamber in which only certain opinions resound. To have knowledge implies the possession of information, facts and skills acquired by persons through experience or education that form the basis of a healthy, well-founded convictions on which we can base our worldview. However, sometimes we fool ourselves. If we are convinced that something is true, we have a tendency to seek confirmation of our own beliefs. This phenomenon is called confirmation bias and has been recognized by psychologists for decades. Instead of exposing our convictions to critical review, we do all we can to confirm them, ignoring information that conflicts or challenges those convictions. Confirmation bias, then, is the human equivalent of the algorithms and plays a central role in understanding people's ability to form an idea of the world, offering a direct parallel to the algorithm's ability to compile social media feeds. Thus, in social media, an unfortunate reinforcement effect arises when human confirmation bias meets algorithms filtering and information prioritization. The effect becomes even more difficult to construct an accurate view of reality. Donald Trump has repeatedly used the term fake news whenever he hears something that doesn't fit with or challenges his own view of the world. A folder in his morning brief containing nothing but positive news is a filter bubble in miniature that excludes all negativity. The effect is a well-developed immunity to facts, in which Mr. Trump's case began to develop long before he became president. It is, however, also an example of, quote, political motivated reasoning, end quote, to use Dan Kanan's term. Mr. Kane is a professor of law and psychology at Yale Law School, who, together with his colleagues, has studied our tendency to seek confirmation of the opinions associated with our own ideological and cultural group. Their research shows that when an issue is politically charged, we often base our convictions on emotions instead of evidence. By his frequent habit of ending his tweet with "sad," Donald Trump offers a practical illustration of this phenomenon. The result of politically motivated reasoning is polarization and negation of the facts. What we believe about various issues becomes an effect of our political thinking rather than any well-founded knowledge of objective facts. It's the reason why political debates are so boring to watch nowadays. The opponents are mainly occupied with expressing what they believe and think and feel without any connection to facts. Confirmation bias and politically motivated reasoning create excellent conditions for those who wish to disseminate fake news. By creating headlines that appear to confirm existing convictions, the creators of fake news lead us to click on links to learn more in the hope of having these convictions confirmed. One should keep in mind that there is money to be made in the advertising associated with stories, so the more titillating and inflammatory the headline, the more money gets made by those fake news creators. This is a point worth making, as there are some who don't care about the ideology and are only in it for the money. One of the most notorious examples of fake news during the 2016 US presidential campaign was the Pope's supposed support for Donald Trump. Over 1 million people liked and shared this false article. Of course, the Pope does not endorse political candidates. If we compare the 20 most popular news articles about the US election on Facebook in the 4 months preceding Election Day in November 2016, with the 20 most popular fake news articles during the same period, we get an idea of just how strong an impulse confirmation bias is. The total number of reactions, that is likes, comments, etc., to the fake news amounted to 8.7 million, compared to 7.3 million for the verified news. The underlying purpose of social media, and all other digital services that offer personalization, is to persuade users to use the service in question as much as possible. The problem is that users have neither insight into nor the ability to influence the weight that algorithms attach to various types of information and behavior. There is no off button for algorithms that I could have preferred to view my friend post in a chronicler order. That's not possible today. Over recent years, algorithms have been developed in an attempt to include things that I had no idea that I liked. This is done by comparing my individual profile with other profiles that are in some way similar to mine, and using information about what these other users like in order to suggest the same things to me. Put simply, the algorithm creates a stereotype that can be used to make assumptions about what I ought to like and make recommendations or suggesting accordingly. This is presumably why I never see articles about yoga in my feed, despite my interest in the subject. I am, after all, a man, and the stereotypical yoga practitioner is a woman. This is also a sign that an algorithm is never completely neutral. The biases and values of those who create algorithms affect the code. Normally, we are oblivious to this, simply because the programmers themselves give no thought of it and have no insight into the biases it introduces on our behalf. Thus, there are many interactive factors that make it difficult to create an accurate worldview. Add to this fact that the media landscape is considerably more fragmented than a few decades ago. It's easy to understand those who blame digital media in general for this development and who point out that social media contributes to a polarizing of the public discourse. Their proposed solution is to demand accountability on the part of these social networks and the new platforms for the users' worldviews. By altering digital and social media algorithms who suggest news articles that challenges the world's view of the user, they should be able to prevent the formation of filter bubbles, they say. I have several reservations about such a proposal. First, the proposal is based on the assumption that our worldview is solely formed by our social media feeds. as if we never thumbed to a newspaper, never seen television news, never picked up something on the radio or listened to our friends express their opinions on current affairs. So digital media alone cannot be blamed for the creation of filter bubbles. If you choose to read only a certain type of newspaper, perhaps with a more conservative bent, you also risk becoming trapped in a filter bubble. Second, social networks and platforms are not democratic institutions. On joining, we accept terms and conditions that clearly stipulate that we can neither exercise influence over how the service is designed, nor demand accountability for any undesirable effects that we may experience as a regular user. Third, I am opposed to the idea that someone or an algorithm would diagnose my feed in order to ascertain whether my worldview is balanced and thereafter medicate me until such time as balance is restored to my news consumption. I understand that the intention is good, but the solution remains absurd. The fourth reservation is simply to state the obvious. All attempts to correct someone's self-image against their expressed wishes is in opposition to all liberal ideas about the individual's right to self-determination. My delusions may lack credence, but they are still mine. Over the course of several decades, in many countries, the state's responsibility for, and therefore its ability to decide on behalf of, its citizens has decreased in favor of increased opportunities for citizens to take their own responsibility and make their own decisions. The idea that our corporations should take responsibility for ensuring that users are generally educated, much in the way that the European welfare state sought to do for the citizens in the mid-1950s, is as outdated as it is absurd. A fifth reservation takes the form of a reminder that about our ability to consciously or unconsciously create our own filter bubbles by searching for information that affirms our own worldview, our confirmation biases. Even if algorithms were to provide us with a balanced diet of news, we would still give greater weight to any news that confirm our understanding to that challenges it. Nevertheless, I think I understand why this proposal arose. When we view filter bubbles as a technical challenge, we automatically search for a technical solution on which to pin our hopes. However, the problem is more complex than that we can hope to solve by simply altering some algorithms. The problem is intrinsically linked to our inability to take responsibility for our own news diet, our ignorance for our inherent confirmation bias, and of the resulting confining filter bubble. If we are to solve this problem, we need general education on where the responsibility lies for the existence of our filter bubbles, and that is with each and every one of us. Not with social media or the platforms, and it's most certainly not with the state, but with you and me and everyone trying to obtain a balanced view of the world. The solution is to educate people about this responsibility, to help them take control of their information gathering and perform basic source criticism. This realization that one exists with a big bubble of some kind is a first important step. Deceptive filter bubbles. It seems to me both Donald Trump's and Hillary Clinton's campaign organizers were clearly unaware of the extent to which filter bubbles were polarizing their presidential election. Instead of an election campaign where all citizens were able to listen to or read the candidates' arguments on important social issues, it would be fair to describe the Trump and Clinton campaigns as entirely separate, parallel competitions aimed at getting the largest possible percentage of their own constituency into the polling station to vote. Rather than discussing politics or giving more thought to which arguments seemed attractive to their rival supporters at campaign rallies, both sides resorted to describing their adversary in emotional terms as mentally unstable or other unflattering terms. One must remember that everyone who votes in an election does so because the choice seems somehow logical. To dismiss one's adversary in emotional terms as morally corrupt and their supporters as ideologically extreme, poorly educated numbskulls, or as a self-righteous elite, is to subconsciously filter out facts that challenge our beliefs and restrict the opportunity to understand the world. This is an example of the politically motivated reasoning we spoke of earlier. Emotions affect our ability to make an objective judgment. I once considered myself to be reasonably well-informed about U.S. domestic politics. Since I worked at a campaign on Barack Obama's first presidential campaign in 2008, I followed U.S. politics from a distance, with interest and admittedly to a liberal filter. This confirmation bias left me unable to understand how anyone could consider voting for Donald Trump. Fascinated by my own inability to grasp that idea, I manipulated Twitter's algorithms to recommend like-minded accounts so I could create two separate filter bubbles, led one by Republican and one by Democratic Twitter users. This allowed me to begin studying the bubbles from within, hearing the arguments as if I was an entirely normal Trump or Clinton supporter. In character, these bubbles were extremely similar to one another. Each had its influential voices, its fair share of fake news, its rowdy supporters, and loyal media outlets routinely ridiculing the other candidates. In both bubbles, astonishment was rife on how the hell any reasonable person could even consider voting for the other bubble's dimwit candidate. Both bubbles seemed to scent victory, and yet both sides expressed great surprise when the election results were in. No one expected Donald Trump to win. Someone so politically inexperienced, with such a tarnished reputation as a New York real estate billionaire, should not have been able to win a primary, should not have been able to become a presidential candidate, and should not have been able to be elected president. If you were to compare him to previous candidates and the scrutiny they were subject to, and the conduct that was experienced before they could win the trust of the people and their votes, the result was unprecedented. Yet, filter bubbles are insufficient as an explanation for why Donald Trump won the presidential campaign. Then again, filter bubbles explain why so many people guessed wrong, despite the signal that the Clinton victory was far from secure. When we see only what confirms our own worldview, it's inevitably that we misinterpret signs to the contrary. Faced with the facts that, and with the demand to explain how they came about, this is perhaps unworthy of a political expert to point a finger to blame elsewhere, even if this is human. If you believe in your own objectivity, confirmation bias itself will ensure that the idea of being influenced by confirmation bias is dismissed before you can even have time to consider the possibility. After the unexpected yes vote on Brexit in June 2016, many pundits laid the blame for the prognostic fiasco squarely at the feet of pollster. After the unexpected result in US presidential election, criticism was primarily aimed at deceptive algorithms and the filter bubbles they create. Why had Facebook failed to enlighten its users of its possibility? Why did no alarm sound indicating that the message in the feed mirrored the monotonous reverberation of an echo chamber with false information swirling in the mix? Audible echo chambers. Day-to-day behavior, such as how we use media, obtain news, or consume music, might take time to change. It is difficult to change behavior overnight. However, if change takes place in increments, we will perceive it as a simplification or as something people we know are already doing, and we will adapt ourselves surprisingly quickly and without giving it much thought. In order to show how much media habits can change in only a few decades, we need only to look at how the music industry had changed over the same period. The algorithms that control Spotify, Apple Music and other streaming services offer us suggestions for new artists and new songs based on what we already like. Initially, this seems great as the algorithm makes a search for new music much easier. However, as the artist suggester never deviates from a given genre, the feeling sneaks up on us that we are being consigned to an echo chamber. One day not so long ago, it dawned on me that all of the artists suggested to me by Spotify were singer-songwriters. All that remained was slow, sonorous voices accompanied by guitar or piano. Nora Jones, James Blunt, Joni Mitchell, Ellie Goulding, Tracy Chapman. The problem is, it's not that what I like. Not only, anyway. My musical taste is considerably more varied than that, but for some reasons, algorithms appear to have given more weight to those particular artists. Something that first irritated me and then made me angry. Why weren't these algorithms fulfilling their functions? And if that was the case, why shouldn't I be able to reset the algorithms or ask them to re-index the information in my listening history to correctly reflect my tastes? If you compare the music feed with the news feed, there are no real difference. They both work in the same way and according to the same logic. The major difference is, of course, that you can hear when your music feeds have become an echo chamber, quite literally. At certain points in this book, we will, therefore, take a diversion via music. By understanding how certain artists broke through and how the public reacted to the death of an artist, we can compare media habits at various points in time, how news is communicated, and how it's received. Donald Trump's relationship with music is largely unknown. However, in an interview with the BBC, he did admit he liked to listen to Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Elton John, and Eminem. Quote, "If you love a certain kind of music, don't let other people's tastes influence your own," end quote, said Trump in his book Think Like a Billionaire. Quote, "Whatever the best is for you is the best. Never forget that," end quote. This advice to create an echo chamber filled with music you already like is reminiscent of his desire to only receive positive news in his file or press clippings. The most dangerous filter bubble of all is the belief that you have a handle on the situation. Of course, both algorithms and confirmation biases contribute to reinforcing this belief, but it also demands a degree of narcissism to believe that you already have an accurate picture of reality. An unwillingness to accept new information or influences from new sources is a worrying sign, implying, as it does, that you already have the necessary knowledge. Indeed, doubting your own understanding of the world is a sign of a sound mind. The book The Big Bubble, How Technology Makes It Harder to Understand the World by Per Grönqvist is available where all you find books.